Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Between Ape and Human, an anthropologist on the trail of a hidden hominoid, by Gregory Forth. Narrated by Mike Cooper. Publisher's note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and e-book formats of the book. 1. Ape Men of Flores Island. In the far reaches of the Indonesian archipelago lies Flores, 8.6574 degrees south, 121.0794 degrees east, a long, narrow island of high mountains, precipitous cliffs, and deep ravines. The climate is tropical. Rain is seasonal and is heavy when the west monsoon winds blow from October to April, definitely the wet season in this part of the archipelago. In southern regions, though, and in the high mountain forests that cover the island's interior, rain can fall in any month. By contrast, Flores's north coast, including a narrow coastal plain that runs along much of the island, enjoys far less rain, is less fertile, and reveals a semi-arid landscape. Thus, it is only certain parts of the island that live up to the name Flores, flowers, which early Portuguese navigators took from Tanjung Bunga, Cape of Flowers, a name given by their Malay-speaking pilots to the island's eastern and, ironically, not particularly verdant extremity. Why precisely they called the Cape flowery remains a mystery. Like the rest of Indonesia, Flores belongs to the famous Ring of Fire, the great chain of volcanoes that encircles the Pacific Ocean. Even by Indonesian standards, Flores is highly volcanic, another factor conducive to plant fertility. Yet, contrary to what volcanoes, monsoon rains, and tropical forests might suggest, native animal life is neither rich nor varied. Because of the island's location, well east of Wallace's line, named after Alfred Wallace, the renowned naturalist, and with Darwin, co-founder of evolutionary theory, Flores falls within the Australasian zoogeographical region and is poor in mammal species. Australia is obviously located in the same region, but Flores lacks the marsupials found on the Great Island continent. Native mammals include mostly rats and bats, so most of the larger mammals now found on the island, including both wild animals, monkeys, exclusively Macaca fascicularis, or long-tailed macaques, porcupines, civets, and deer, and domestic species, pigs, water buffalo, goats, horses, dogs, and cats, were brought to Flores by human immigrants from the north or west, the earliest presumably coming in outrigger canoes. While not short of birds and reptiles, including crocodiles and at least four species of venomous snakes, Flores therefore lacks, indeed has never had, such large animals as the tigers, leopards, bears, modern elephants and rhinoceroses, characteristic of larger western Indonesian islands and mainland Southeast Asia. For what comes later, it's important to mention that Flores has never had apes either. Those large, tailless primates represented by orangutans on Borneo and Sumatra and by gibbons on Borneo, Sumatra, Java and Bali. But what Flores lacks in animal variety, it certainly makes up for in the remarkable character of several native species. Among these is the world's largest rat, the aptly named Flores giant rat, Papagomis armonvillei. A ferocious, mostly tree-dwelling beast that, including the tail, grows up to 80 centimetres long, or over 2.5 feet. The rat is an island endemic, meaning it is found only on Flores. And almost endemic is the world's largest lizard, the Komodo dragon, Varanus komodoensis, a voracious carnivore and ambush predator with a venomous bite that can attain a length of more than 3 metres, nearly 10 feet. Other than Flores, the dragon only occurs on its namesake island of Komodo and other small islands, all immediately west of Flores. Looking back into prehistory, I could also mention the evolution on Flores of now extinct pygmy stegodons, elephant-like creatures no larger than a cow. But the subject of this book is an even more remarkable and even less expected animal, or perhaps two animals of very similar kinds. One is an extremely small-bodied fossil human named Homo floresiensis, Flores human. The species is known only from remains found in 2003 at Liangbua, Bua Cave in western Flores. Standing little more than a metre, 3 feet 3 inches tall, the height of a 2 to 3 year old Western child, the tiny species quickly became nicknamed the Hobbit after the Tolkien characters. In view of this hobbit's skeletal features, described as archaic by paleontologists and in several respects comparable to those of Australopithecines, prehistoric southern apes that lived from 2 to 4 million years ago, or even chimpanzees, another surprise was the species' extraordinarily recent dates. Initially, the last known date for Floresiensis was estimated at just 12,000 years ago, or 18,000 years ago for the type specimen, or holotype, that is, the most complete of several skeletons found at the same site. More recently, the date was revised to 50 to 60,000 years ago, but in geological terms, this is still remarkably young. The discovery caused a sensation in the scientific world and captured the attention of the general public as well. And in spite of initial controversy, research conducted after the discovery has confirmed that Homo floresiensis is a new species. The other human-like creature alluded to earlier, which for convenience I call an ape man, has yet to be scientifically identified. But one of several ethno-linguistically distinct groups that populate Flores Island, a people called Leo, claims these creatures are alive, if not well, in remote sections of their mountainous territory. In their own language, the Leo name these ape men Lei Hoa. They describe them as small, in fact about the same size as Floresiensis, as walking upright on two legs, and as hairy-bodied, or at any rate hairier than themselves. Leo also characterize the ape men as cultureless, lacking tools, weapons, clothing, and even fire. Floresiensis, too, might have been hairy, though we shall never know. And while the question has yet to be settled, there's no firm evidence for the fossil species having used either fire or stone tools. Although often described as taller or larger-bodied, human-like creatures like these ape men have been reported for other parts of Flores Island, Indonesia, and other parts of the world. But adding to the intrigue of the Lei Hoa is the fact that, unlike similar beings reported from other parts of Flores, which local people consider extinct, these ape men are claimed to have survived to the present. In addition, individual Leo offer credible accounts of specimens they have seen, including eyewitness encounters dating from the 1960s to the decade of 2010 to 2019. And all this on an island that, for thousands of years, was home to an archaic species of Homo, the genus that includes Homo sapiens, which, according to the reconstructions of paleoanthropologists, anthropologists who study prehistoric humans, seem to have differed hardly at all from the Leo ape man. So far as we know with any certainty, modern humans, or what paleoanthropologists more exactly call anatomically modern humans, first reached Flores around 11,000 years ago, at the end of the Pleistocene, or Ice Age. By contrast, Homo floresiensis had been living on the island since around 100,000 years ago, and the species' ancestors may have arrived much earlier. Because dates are only available from a single site, when floresiensis disappeared, or even if it disappeared, is not known. As for the ape men, there's reason to believe they could be present-day descendants of floresiensis, and if so, it could mean that this species still shares Flores with modern humans. Alternatively, species X, as the ape men might also be called, could descend from a similarly small-sized species that reached Flores over 1 million years ago and that may have been the ancestor of Homo floresiensis as well, but through a different line. On the other hand, the human-like creatures Leo speak of could be purely imaginary. Which solution is best supported by the evidence is what this book is all about. Before going any further, it's important to distinguish two similar-sounding terms, including one found in my subtitle. Meaning human-like, hominoid describes any creature that looks like a human but is not a human, or at least not a physically modern human. Hominin, by contrast, refers to a group or scientific tribe that includes all species of the genus Homo, thus Homo sapiens, Homo erectus, and Homo floresiensis, as well as the Australopithecines. The Australopithecines include several species of erect-standing, bipedal apes known only from Africa, of which one apparently later gave rise to the genus Homo. At the risk of complicating things further, hominins form part of a larger group called hominids, note the D in place of the second N, the zoological family Hominidae, which also includes the great apes, chimpanzees, gorillas, and sometimes orangutans. Mostly to vary the prose, I use hominoid, not hominid or hominin, as an alternative to ape man. That said, I recognize that if the ape men were relatives of Floresiensis, they would be hominins too. As for the most modern of hominins, Homo sapiens, our chief interest lies in the Leo people, briefly introduced just before. Like other Flores Islanders, Leo possess a fascinating and, in many respects, little explored indigenous culture. But for present purposes, their main importance is as the sole witnesses to the continuing existence of ape men, or what are possibly non-sapiens hominins, on their island. Living some 300 to 400 kilometres east of the Western Flores site, where Homo floresiensis was discovered, Leo occupy the largest part of east-central Flores, one of the island's most mountainous regions. Though Leo territory extends to Flores's north and south coasts, especially in the south, the highlands begin just a kilometre or less from the sea. This is rugged country by any standard, and even with modern roads, and if one drove straight through, the journey from Flores's western extremity to Leo's western boundary can take 15 hours. The Indonesian government does not keep records for ethnic populations. As Leo people are divided between two neighbouring administrative districts, their current number is not recorded. But according to the broadest definition of Leo, it is likely around 100,000. At present, though, most Leo live near the south coast or in other, mostly southern regions traversed by the Trans-Flores Highway, which runs from one end of the island to the other. For a long time, Leo inhabiting coastal regions have travelled locally by sea and engaged in sea fishing while also growing crops. But even today, only a minority of men are primarily or exclusively fishermen, and permanent coastal settlements of any size are a recent development. As this might suggest, traditionally, and to a large extent still today, Leo make their living as cultivators and occasional hunters. They also raise domestic animals, which until recently were used exclusively as animal sacrifices in indigenous rituals and as items of exchange, chiefly as bride price given by a man's family for a wife. Not long ago, Leo mainly practiced slash and burn or swidden cultivation in highland gardens carved out of mountain forests, where they planted corn, maize, dry field rice, millet, and other cereals and a variety of vegetables and tubers. The gardens were maintained for several years before plots were abandoned so the forest could grow back. In the 1930s and 1940s, part of the population began cultivating rice in permanent irrigated fields located in lower lying places closer to the coast. About the same time, some Leo also abandoned highland villages to build settlements nearer to paddy fields and modern roads, initially built by Dutch colonialists who first arrived on the island early in the 20th century and left after Indonesian independence in 1945. Even so, many cultivators still plant highland gardens and continue to reside at higher elevations, often at a considerable distance from roads and the sites of other modern institutions. During the 20th century, Leo forests shrank due to human population expansion. Yet the highest mountains remain covered in jungle, not least in several sections where forests are protected by government order. And it is mainly in these regions that the Leo say people, very occasionally, encounter ape men. Understanding ape men and what people say about them. The ape man is a figure I've reconstructed from the statements of numerous Leo people. I've never seen an ape man, and partly for this reason, some listeners may want to dismiss any resemblance between these creatures and apparently long-extinct hominins as mere coincidence. One purpose of this book is to question such dismissal. I can immediately discount the possibility that the ape man simply reflects local familiarity with the scientific discovery and reconstruction of Homo floresiensis. I was lucky. I first recorded physical descriptions of the Leo ape man in July 2003, a month before a team of paleoanthropologists came across the remains of floresiensis in August of 2003, and well over a year before the discovery was announced to the public in October 2004. Even after that time, very few Flores Islanders learned much about the discovery, and those that did, mainly educated people with access to modern media, accepted the opinion of Tuku Jacob, an Indonesian paleoanthropologist, who dismissed Floresiensis as a deformed modern human and a 7,000-year-old ancestor of certain short-statured villagers currently living close to the Floresiensis discovery site at Liang Bua. But even though ape men are an indigenous idea, this doesn't mean they exist as flesh and blood creatures and thus a real natural species, as opposed to an imaginary being existing only in people's minds. In the first case, there's the further question of what sort of species. If not some sort of hominin, including perhaps a largely hidden group of modern humans, Liao's statements about ape men might reflect non-human animals, either already known, monkeys for example, or a species scientifically undiscovered. Incredible as it may seem, most evidence points to a hominin other than Homo sapiens. Anyone can dismiss as mythical anything whose existence has yet to be proven, but actually demonstrating that the ape men are imaginary is no easy task. One might attempt to show that the thing's existence contradicts the laws of physics or principles of biological evolution as these are currently known. To be sure, some Leo make what sound like fantastic claims about ape men, for example, that they're able to disappear or even fly, yet many other Leo do not, adhering to a thoroughly naturalistic depiction. And if it is supposed that such naturalistically represented things do not exist, for anthropologists at least, there is still the question of why people think they do. Indeed, why some give seemingly credible accounts of ape man sightings. I certainly don't claim to be able to fully prove the hominoids exist, but there's a simple way to test how likely it is that ape men are completely fantastic. This is to compare them with what Leo say about more definitely imaginary and fantastical entities, specifically supernatural or spiritual beings, as I do in Chapter 3. Even after showing how ape men differ radically from spirits, at least one possible physical feature reduces their credibility as beings comparable to scientifically recognized hominins. For the fact is that some Leo say ape men possess a short tail. This claim I examine at some length, if the pun be excused, in the next chapter. However the tale might be explained, though, it should be stressed that not everything people ascribe to a creature, even supernatural abilities, needs to be accurate for the creature to exist. Among zoological kinds, apparently impossible traits often combine with straightforwardly credible features to disguise the identity of a real animal. Later, we'll meet several animals that Leo describe as supernaturally powerful, but which are unquestionably real species. For present purposes, though, another apparently fantastic creature may serve to make the general point. Leo called this creature Biku. The Biku is largely nocturnal. It has a head and face like a dog, and a long bushy tail like a cat, and it lives in trees. Alternatively, people describe the Biku as looking like a large bat, though it lacks wings. Females as well as males possess testicles. In fact, the creature grows an additional testicle every year until it attains a full complement of 12. Thus complete, it climbs a tree and wails throughout the night. Then at sunrise, it drops dead. Had I not been familiar with variants of the name Biku from other Indonesian languages, I would likely have taken this for an imaginary, supernatural being. In fact, the creature is the palm civet, Paradoxurus hermaphroditus, as Leo themselves recognize. The civet does have a head closely resembling the head of a small dog or a flying fox, a large fruit bat. Also, the animal is mostly nocturnal and arboreal, and it really does wail. The counterfactual element is the multiple testicles. Yet even these have a basis in zoological reality, for the organs in question are actually scent glands that resemble testicles, and their possession by both females and males is reflected in the species' Latin name, Hermaphroditus. Of course, similarly questionable aspects of the ape man cannot be resolved in quite the same way. Whereas I've seen civets in Leo and other parts of Flores, I don't have a physical specimen of an ape man to compare with what Leo say the hominoids look like. Nevertheless, as a cultural anthropologist, someone trained in the detailed study and interpretation of cultural traditions and social systems, and as an ethnozoologist, or folk zoologist, who explores local, non-academic knowledge of animals, I am familiar with the variety of ways humans speak and think about animals. As an anthropologist, I'm especially alert to how particular statements may reflect the sorts of experiences people may have with animals, or indeed not have, and furthermore, how these statements may reflect personal and social interests or connect with shared representations of a community, or what is commonly called the cultural context. And to this task, I also bring a background in Eastern Indonesian languages. I need to say more about how I came to know what I know about ape men. All my studies on flores have been broadly ethnographic, meaning that I investigate how people organize their social and spiritual lives, what they believe, and what they consider valid knowledge. And like all ethnographers, I've pursued this research by living with local people over long periods of time and conversing with them in languages in which they are fluent. My first stint of fieldwork on flores was in 1984. Before that, I spent a full 2 years on the neighbouring island of Sumba, where I completed my doctoral research. Since 1984, I've returned to flores 19 times, typically spending 2 to 3 months in the field, thus amounting to a total of some 4 to 5 years. The bulk of my flores research has been among the Nage people of West Central Flores, and it was among the Nage that I first heard about mystery hominoids on the island. Later, in 2003, I began new fieldwork among the Leo, and it was in that year that, quite by chance, I first heard about the Leo ape men. Focusing mainly on these hominoids and other local creatures, I continued my Leo research in 2005 and during 5 successive years from 2014 to 2018. During these years, I lived mostly in the eastern Leo district of Mego. Being less fluent in Leo than I am in Nage, a large part of my ethnographic conversations with Leo people, so informal and open-ended have they usually been that I hesitate to call them interviews, were conducted in the Indonesian national language, Bahasa Indonesia, in which nowadays virtually all Leo are fluent. I've been speaking Indonesian now for over 45 years, since I started my fieldwork on Sumba in 1975. At the same time, the Leo language is closely related to Nage, and I'm familiar with much vocabulary, especially terminologies used in talking about physical and behavioural aspects of humans and animals, a knowledge that greatly benefited discussions about ape men and much else. As already indicated, my major objective in this book is to compare two sorts of reconstructions. One sort is the reconstructions paleoanthropologists have produced of extinct or presumably extinct hominins. Often, these have been made on the basis of sparse physical evidence. For example, the initial evidence for the Denisovan hominins who lived some 40,000 years ago in Siberia included no more than the bones of a single little finger. Similarly, the remains of 700,000-year-old possible ancestors of Homo floresiensis consist only of fragments of a single mandible and several teeth. The other sort of reconstruction, and the subject of this book, is of the Leo ape men, and the evidence in this case is not mute physical objects, but what people say. For the most part, then, what follows is a book of stories, including stories by people who claim to have seen either living ape men or, in at least two instances, their corpses. Altogether, these take up 4 chapters, 5 to 8, preceded by a chapter 4 that discusses the relatively few appearances ape men make in Leo myths and legends. Attributed to several different sources is the proposition that there are no truths, only stories. A variant substitutes interpretations for stories. My approach follows the spirit of both statements. No doubt some would want to exempt scientific truths from the principle, and in the context of the present inquiry, perhaps assert that all the talk in the world is not worth a single finger bone. But even tiny bones require an interpretation, and such interpretations are typically part of larger paleoanthropological stories, often as appealing for the cast of fully modern characters they portray and the twists and turns of academic fates as they are for what they tell us of humans or human-like creatures in the past. In addition, scientific claims to truth are always provisional, necessarily being subject, unlike religious truths or God's truth, to falsification. Many people, it seems, think that when scientific propositions are shown to be wrong, this reflects badly on science. But on the contrary, when decisively proven wrong, or even when seriously cast in doubt, science is actually advanced rather than weakened. The unlikely discovery of Homo floresiensis definitely changed our understanding of hominin evolution. Physical evidence for a contemporary non-sapiens hominin, which, however unlikely it might seem, is not impossible in principle, would naturally shake things up further still. For the time being, though, we have to make do with what fellow human beings tell us. In this respect, the present investigation might be called an exercise in cryptozoology, the study of hidden or undiscovered animals. Of course, the ape men are not undiscovered by the Leo, so in this context, undiscovered can only mean not documented or recognized by scientists, something typically involving the apprehension by people with the proper scientific qualifications and professional connections of either a living specimen or other tangible physical evidence. Tracks might do, but photographs and recordings of vocalizations are more controversial. Usually, cryptozoologists don't possess such evidence, but instead construct their arguments for the existence of scientifically unrecognized animals on statements by ordinary folk who claim to have seen one. And since I take what Leo say about ape men seriously, as possibly reflecting a real animal, then this study can be called cryptozoological. At the same time, as an anthropologist, I'm fully aware that verbal evidence of any kind can be fabricated, exaggerated, or simply mistaken. I'm mainly talking, of course, about statements by people who claim to have seen ape men. One can go some way toward assessing the probable veracity of putative sightings by considering not only the physical setting and people's descriptions of what they saw. Does it sound like another animal, a monkey, say, or a tree stump, or rock, or indeed something dreamt? But also the personality, character, and social status of witnesses, including what interest they may have in representing something in a particular way. Certainly, I place less reliance on accounts by people of a supernatural bend, most notably dealers in magically powerful ape-man body parts or substances, a topic explored in Chapter 3, and people of power, atabhisa, or people of skill or knowledge, atambio. These are typically men who have a personal, one might also say a professional, interest in claiming experience of things unfamiliar to others. As they serve as spiritual healers, magicians, and sorcerers, I also call these men of power mystical practitioners. Obviously, the most valuable sighting reports are those where two or more people claimed to have seen the same thing simultaneously, and I was fortunately able to record several such accounts. But even in these instances, all or both witnesses could have been mistaken or misremembered what they saw. So, it may still be asked, how can I be sure that anything I heard reflects a natural, zoological reality or a creature corresponding to a scientifically unknown species? The short answer is that I can't. Even so, several considerations reduce my uncertainty and may do the same for listeners. I begin with dishonesty and deliberate deception. Deception by informants is an easy charge to level at anthropologists. Researchers can find individuals given to deception in any field setting. As already indicated, there are ways of identifying people, with reference to both personal traits and social position or interests, who are particularly inclined to dissimulate or exaggerate. But there are also reasons to believe that a good deal of what people tell any anthropologist is accurate, at least in people's honest understanding. Here I should stress that most of what people said about ape men agreed with what others said, and where accounts diverged from common views of the hominoids, it was usually possible to find a reason why. One reason for thinking that what most people say most of the time is not made up is that deliberate deception and fabrication require effort. It's far easier for people to either tell the truth, as they see it, or simply say they don't know. Surely the best way to get rid of a troublesome anthropologist. Not only that, fabrication requires a motive. Sometimes people may tell mistruths to convey what they think an inquirer wants to hear, but it's anything but clear why Leo might have thought I was soliciting thoroughly naturalistic depictions of ape men. In fact, it's more likely that some people were inclined to stress, for my benefit, the supernatural aspects of the hominoids. This is partly because people knew I was also interested in such things as local spirits, witches, and magical beliefs and practices. Another reason is that some people were interested in selling me ape-man relics, or were individuals who claimed supernatural abilities, those men of power again. Significantly, though, the accounts I found most credible, including reports from putative eyewitnesses, came from men and women who fell into neither category. Sometimes mistruths might be told as a way of pulling someone's leg, particularly...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?